there, folks. Want to thank you for tuning in to episode 3 of the J.D. Rieger Talking Podcast. First off, I want to thank my guest this week, Eric Friedel, a.k.a. Eric Oblivion, for letting me invade his office space at Goner Records about 2 weeks ago to tape this podcast. One little note about our conversation, this was taped between games 2 and 3 of the Western Conference Finals, so that explains the timeliness of Eric's commentary about the possibility of the Grizzlies making the NBA Finals. A couple of things before we get into the conversation I want to promote. The Neo Reaches, which is a band that I play in, is going to do a show at the Poplar Lounge on June 18th. I think that's a Wednesday. And I'm also putting out a record by my friend Jason Pulley on my label Unclaimed Recordings. And that is going to, the release show for that is going to be July 13th, also at the Poplar Lounge. Speaking of Unclaimed Recordings, if you listen to the last episode, you know that I put out a record by a band called The Perfect Vessels, and you can download or listen to that record at their website, perfectvessels.com. So now that we've done all that, let's get on to the podcast interview with Eric Friedel. Thanks, y'all. So I guess my agenda to talk to you is about many things, but mostly about how you just got like a fascinating mix of careers, you know, between the record store, the label, the bands, and working for the Grizzlies. Now I'd like to talk about all of that if you're cool with that.
I'm fine.
Well, let's start since we're in the middle of a huge playoff run right now. Let's talk about your role with the Memphis Grizzlies. How long have you worked for them?
Probably about 10 years, something like that.
So since the beginning?
Since the beginning. I got pulled in. There's a really strange crew that was working at the Pyramid for the Grizzlies.
Strange how?
And when I say working for the, we're all independent contractors. We are not actually, we are paid by the Grizzlies, but we are not part of the Grizzlies organization officially.
Okay. So.
But they brought Mike McCarthy in to run the video department or something, some agency. And he brought in his friend Wheat, who's a technical genius, brought in Alicia Trout. Chris Walker might have been working there already, but I think Mike probably brought him in. So all these people ended up working down at the Pyramid. And eventually I got the call to help out as someone couldn't do it or whatever. And we were basically connecting cables and making sure shot clocks didn't go out and everything. And so I hung around there, and eventually they figured out I could do something else. And, you know, they took me over, guy that we worked for, Richard Brewer, grabbed me, and I worked over at the Cannon Center for a while, basically doing the same thing, just basic opening doors for people, connecting cables, showing people where everything was. And then when the Pyramid closed and the FedEx Forum opened, they brought me over there, and I did graphics. They figured out I could do graphics after coiling cables behind cameramen for a while. And so I started doing graphics, and now I do graphics for the Tigers, real basic, putting stuff up on kind of titles and things for people, scrolls of names of graduating seniors, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Thrilling.
And for the Grizzlies, we do the LED lights. I help another guy do LED lights that go around running ads, telling people that was a 3-point play, fantastic dunk. My favorite ones that we run are brick and traveling, because we never run those, so that always gets me really excited. But I mean, it's pretty fun. The whole game presentation and kind of keeping people excited with music and the lights and everything.
Yeah.
And the PA announcing, it's pretty interesting. And the guy that runs all that stuff, Jason Potter, is really good. So, everybody that works down there is really good. So it's really fun. It seems like a kind of silly thing, but we're way up in the top next to the audio guy, which I love being up there. You can really see the court really well. It's really not that far. It's, you know, the nosebleed seats if you were paying for the seats.
Oh, yeah, that's where I sit.
Yeah, and I think it's great. You know, you really have – it's awesome being courtside, but I really don't mind being up there, and the fans are great. It's always fun being at the games.
And you've been with them in the lean years.
Oh yeah, I love the underdog type of thing. So I love the Grizzlies in their bad years, and it's fun to see them put things together, sort of in the same mold of, you know, just being hardworking without the super duper stars. You know, back when Lorenzen was our big guy and everything. You know, it's always been fun.
I heard somewhere that you might have played a role in the playoff tradition of Jerry Lawler cameos. Is that something that might have been your idea?
I definitely was a proponent of that. I don't know if I came up with the idea, but
seems like someone I thought I saw on the Facebook somewhere where someone was either giving you credit or maybe you were taking credit for that somehow.
I don't know. It was a good idea.
That was
a
smart
move. Came up with it, the first time he came out was one of the best moments in Grizzlies basketball. So it was really fun.
How does your commitment to the Grizzlies games and the Tigers games like affect your like musical career now?
I mean,
you're not able to tour around, you know, Grizzlies schedule, or is that not true?
Well, yeah, I mean, I basically know when the season is and block out that kind of stuff. If we made it to the finals, I might have to miss a game because we do have Oblivion's tour, which I don't really tour anymore. True Sons of Thunder are lucky to get down the block, you know, getting out of town. It's our main touring is going to Ohio for some reason, but
you guys are huge in Ohio.
We are huge. Four people know about us in Ohio, so there's not touring isn't that big of a deal. But it is, you know, because the Oblivions have a record coming out, we did book some stuff, and we did not plan on blocking out for the NBA finals.
Sure.
Back whenever that we were booking all that stuff. So,
well, I guess now we'll get into music and start with pre-Oblivions. Like, what kind of bands and stuff did you do before the Oblivions, before the stuff people would know you for?
When I was in high school, I played, I tried to sing for a band that, the band was good. I was terrible. And they started out kind of being a garage band and ended up being a pop band. And they got fancy and ended up actually being a real band in Boston. Eventually they moved.
What were they called?
They ended up being the Dam Builders.
Oh, okay.
They kind of dropped me and added some really good players. Joan Wasser ended up in the band, and she's amazing violin player. And this guy Kevin March was playing drums, who ended up playing with Guided by Voices, I think.
Where were you at this?
Well, we were in Hawaii growing up, but I ended up in Boston with them after I got out of college in LA, and ended up doing sound for them for a European tour. Disastrous European tour, which was awesome. Actually, we were there when the label was based out of Berlin and the wall was coming down. It was perfect time to be in Berlin. It was
wild.
Just completely crazy. Yeah, the wall would one day you would see the wall, and the next day the wall would be gone. Looked like it was never there because they just put the wall down in the middle of the street. Next day the street would go through and you could drive from East. It was bizarre.
Yeah.
Anyway, and we had like 3 weeks off in the middle of the tour, kind of to live in Berlin. It was great. It was terrible tour planning, but fun time to be there. But anyway, so I kind of did that, but that was just kind of half-assed, you know, your kids and everything. And I really didn't do anything else. I'd bang on a bass or something, but I never really learned to play guitar. I was hanging out with Greg and Jack at Shangri-La.
Well, when did you come to Memphis?
I came to Memphis in, I think, 1990. It's kind of blurry because a lot of stuff happened around 1989, 1990. But I'm saying 1990 because I knew Sherman, who owned Shangri-La, he spent a semester in college with me and then hated it and left, but we stayed in touch and did a little fanzine and stuff. He decided to open up his flotation tank business in Memphis, which wasn't going badly, but even if that was slamming, it was real boring, I think. So he was still into music, thought that there was a lack of record stores in Memphis. So he decided to sell records and asked me if I wanted to come down. When I moved down, we had a box of records. That was our record store. But big plans to kind of work it out and, you know, grow. And it really did grow really quickly. So we did that. And so I, you know, started hanging out. And Greg and Jack were doing Painkillers and Compulsive Gambler stuff. And I loved that stuff. It was just a good, weird, sloppy mix of R&B and garage and all kinds of stuff. I just thought it was great. And Greg went out of town, and Jack and I were just goofing around. He showed me some stuff on guitar, and I kind of looked at him and, you know, was, all right, well, what else do you need to know? He's like, that's pretty much it. Just go to it, you know? So Greg came back, and we decided to goof around just by ourselves, and that sort of was the start of the Oblivians.
Do you remember when the first gig you guys played was?
No, I think it was around 93, probably. We had a couple names before.
Do you remember what any of those were?
We were the Gold Diggers with this other guy, Trip, who we were really great in practice, and then Trip would get really drunk. Not Trip from the Grifters, but got really drunk and he was our drummer, but he wanted to play guitar and play Jimi Hendrix songs. Which was interesting, not really what we were going for. And then we were called the Gentlemen of Leisure for a show, Pee Pee and the Nail Drivers.
Nice.
I'm sure I'm forgetting
lots of serious names.
Yeah, we were really serious. And then eventually I think we kind of got an out-of-town gig and we had to come up with a name, and Oblivions stuck. Because once you're out of town, it seems kind of silly to keep changing your name. In town you can do that, but once you're out of town, that's it, I guess. I don't know.
How has it that you guys ended up getting signed to a label?
Well, this is the inside scoop. It's all connections.
Exclusive.
Yeah. So Greg was doing Greg went up to New York to play guitar on this girl Casey Scott's record, and pretty sure he was doing some recording with her. For some reason he had to be up in New York, and Jack had never been to New York, so he was going to go too, and that was two-thirds of our band. So we thought, well, if you came up, maybe we could get some shows. And I was working at Shangri-La and talking to the people at Norton Records, and they're up in New York. So I said, hey, we might be up in New York. Is there anywhere for us to play? We don't have anything, you know, just to open up for somebody. And Norton said, yeah, call Todd Abramson at Maxwell's. Maybe he can get you a show. And Maxwell's is a great club in Hoboken. And Todd said, yeah, man, John Spencer Blues Explosion's playing. You know, they're just starting out. And I think I had their first kind of record or something. We knew John from Pussy Galore stuff. I mean, we never met John, I don't think. Maybe Greg had, I don't know. But so we got to go up and we played, and John loved it. We played a couple shows. We played in Northampton and somewhere else. Completely bombed. Everybody hated us, but John loved us. We gave him a tape and he started talking us up, and then people decided they wanted to put out our records, you know, because he talked it up, I think. I did a single, In the Red did a single, Crip did a single, and then Crip compiled all the singles into a record, and kind of just went from there.
How many records did you guys end up putting out before the reunion madness? Three, four?
There's four, I guess. One of them sort of a outtakes record, then there's a live bootleg that came out, and then a live.
Is that the
Barristers?
Okay.
Well, there's another. The Atlanta one was before that. But yeah, the live ones were fun because the first one just was a really funny show that we had a lot of banter, and we're really pretty good at that point, even though everything's kind of out of tune and everything. We're going between songs fast for us. And the other one we did, we were trying to come up with different covers to put on the Barristers compilation. So we played a lot of songs that we didn't really play other points. So there's a reason to, you know, we thought it was a reason to keep putting out live records rather than, you know, April Wine's fifth live record that's the same songs you've already heard. You sound great still, but, you know. Anyway, so yeah, I think that's about it.
Do you feel like the live records captured what you did better than the studio stuff?
No, I think, I mean, probably. I think the sloppiness and everything was definitely a part of it. And coming back and later when we're playing these shows, looking at people going crazy, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, we're playing the songs probably better now. It's really not what we did back then. You know, we kind of just launched headlong into it and, you know, sometimes made it through it. Most of the time kind of everything fell apart, and that was fine too. You know, we were right there with the audience, just in the middle of it, you know, just a mess.
Was that part of the aesthetic, like the sloppiness or the rambunctiousness?
We didn't think about it, you know. That's the thing, you know. We never really planned anything, and once we had to start planning things and we're working at it, we quit. It really wasn't the point of the band.
Is it weird for you to hear bands now who are obviously influenced by that and who are like purposefully sort of sloppy and rambunctious? Is that,
we got a lot of that. The European bands are really good at that kind of thing. They pick up on something that they like. American bands do kind of naturally, and then they pick it apart. Japanese bands too, they pick it apart and copy it exactly. And you know, it's sort of what they do. Eventually those bands, some of them end up really good once they work through that kind of thing.
Yeah,
but it's just it's not really fun to hear, you know, bands that are completely copying something. But you just hope that, you know, it's a phase. You get excited by something, and you know, you like Alice Cooper, you want to be Alice Cooper for a while. There's nothing wrong with that. You just, you know, hopefully it gets you to the next place, you know.
So at what point did the Oblivion start to fizzle, and you started to do, were you doing other bands at the time too, or just focusing solely on the Oblivions?
I wasn't doing other bands. I was lucky to be in the Oblivions, I thought, you know, because those guys are really good. I never got good. I never really wanted to be good. There's things that I see people do that I wish I could do, but, you know, that's more learning the guitar and things that I just don't have time to, you know, or inclination to really sit there and play guitar for 8 hours a day and figure out a G chord.
Yeah.
That's hard. So that was afterwards, after I had some time and a guitar, basically we did, I guess, the Dutch Masters, and Zach and I did Sector Zero stuff, and True Sons of Thunder kind of fell together, just for, you know, just a chance to play with other people that would be fun and write some goofy songs, you know.
You had some other bands too. There was the Bad Times, which was a very short-lived band.
Yeah, that was probably in the middle of the Oblivions, I think, maybe right after. Yeah, that was me, Jay Retard, and Louis. We just decided to do this thing. Everybody's life was kind of going through some bad times, and me and Jay drove down to New Orleans to record with Louis. We all had written some songs. We were supposed to trade tapes and learn the songs, but we didn't really get that done. So we learned them that day, recorded them, and mixed them the next day. And I think went down and did a show. It's just really thrown together kind of thing. It worked out really great. We, at the time, we thought, oh, it kind of sucks. And then give it 6 months later, you know, we listened to it, and it sounded pretty good. So eventually that came out too.
And there's also the Legs band, the New Memphis Legs.
Yeah, the Legs band was really, that was a fun one. It was kind of, James Arthur moved to Memphis, and sort of the obvious thing to do would to be in a band with James. So I resisted that as long as we could until,
yeah,
you know, we'd go out drinking and riding our bikes around looking for pinball machines and stuff. And eventually we played, and eventually we got Forrest Hughes to play drums with us. And Forrest is was a drummer for the Neckbones. Amazing drummer. And it was just me and James playing guitar, and Forrest's kick drum basically played bass for the band. I mean, it provided so much low end and everything. All of a sudden, James and I sitting in our room playing songs, sounded okay. We thought they were songs, but as soon as Forrest sat down, we were like, oh wow, we're pretty good here, you know. Yeah. He really made it into the band, and we did some recording.
You guys recently did a reunion, didn't you? Or played?
We played at Gonerfest, and that was really fun. I mean, those guys are just so much fun to play with. They're awesome. Just kind of presences. Just James can summon up all kinds of noise out of his guitar, and just crazy stuff. So it was really fun playing with them back then, and the reunion too. They're basic two chord songs, covers of Australian two chord songs or two chord songs we made up. It's really, really fun. We recorded, it was the first kind of laptop recording or computer recording that we had done, and we were convinced that it sounded like crap. And we went back and it didn't sound bad. You know, it was kind of sounded a little digital action rather than, you know, straight reel to reel stuff, but it sounded good. So eventually that came out too.
I've noticed in describing most of your bands, a lot of the same themes, like, you know, simple and primal, like comes up a lot. Where do you think that comes from for you? Like,
You know, I have a toddler, and there's like a inability to communicate, just kind of ends up screaming or whatever. So I think it's, I can't play guitar. You run up into the limitations of that. You know, it's basically sticking to simpler things. Sort of staying with what you know, or just using it's sort of your limitations become your, you know, your strong points, I think. And repetition of things can be interesting. If you know eight chords, you're going to be inclined to play them. You know, if you only know three, you're going to use those three, you know. So that's basically what we do. We don't, you know, go beyond stuff, but when you start playing with different people, it all kind of it's interesting. It might be the same concept, but it turns into different things depending on who you're playing with.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's obvious, I guess, but it's interesting how it works.
Have you ever tried one song with one band and been like, oh no, this should fit this other band better, or vice versa?
Yeah. I mean, we've played for the New Oblivions record, we play a song that was a Dutch Masters song, and it turned into a different kind of feel. And we played Leg's song. We played with the Dutch Masters. And it's different, you know, it gives it a different approach. And we did Memphis Creep Oblivion song was a different deal too. We played that with Dutch Masters, I guess. So yeah, it's always fun to see what, you know, different people are going to bring to the song.
At what point did, well, here it's a kind of a two-part question. At what point did you start Goner, and then which came first, the label or the store?
I did the label first. I put out records and then started doing like a mail order that, you know,
starting in
93, and we did the Oblivions single came out that I did, and put out the Guitar Wolf, their first record.
Early Retards, didn't you do some of that?
And then the Retards single, and then LP came along. And so
actually, if I may, I'd like to jump in there. How did you start, you know, how did you meet and like get involved with Jay, I guess?
Jay loved the Oblivions. Jay was this, you know, little kid that just 15-year-old kid that was in crazy about music and into all kinds of good music at the time. I mean, I don't know how he knew Buddy Holly and the Dead Boys and all that kind of stuff all at once, but he knew it, and he liked the Oblivions and sent us a letter saying, send me something, JX. I'm like, okay, I'll send you I think I had stickers. I sent him a sticker or something. And so we did that, and eventually, you know, I don't really remember how all this stuff happened, but eventually he got me a tape, and it really blew me away. Just the idea that he was playing everything himself, using buckets for drums, recording stuff in his bathroom, and writing songs that were great. You know, they were really perfect three or four chord songs, really punk, really funny, you know, really frustrated,
kind of shockingly
stuff.
Even mature themes,
right? And then doing Buddy Holly covers and things that, you know, you do not expect kids to know. And
Fear covers.
Yeah, and Fear covers that just completely disintegrate.
Yeah.
So I had no idea that he was going to keep progressing at the really fast rate that he did. Maybe I should have known. We weren't thinking about it, you know.
Yeah.
At the time, I thought, this is a cassette. This is an amazing thing. Let's put it out. We did a single, and then I was ready to put more stuff off of the cassette, but he had recorded an album, you know, before we really knew what to do with it. And so we just kept going from there, and, you know, he just skyrocketed with, you know, just kept getting better and better, and
insanely prolific too.
Yeah. And doing the Lost Sounds and everything like that. Just kept changing what he was into and kept moving and keeping himself interested. And it was just amazing to follow that kind of stuff and to see, whatever he was into, you know, just see what he was doing. It was always good.
Yeah. Well, going back to Goner then, I guess, at what point did this store become a reality?
So we're doing, I was doing mail order stuff, and it was a kind of a good time to be doing that. There was not a whole lot of people selling the kind of garagey stuff and weirder stuff. And I started, kind of selling a wider variety of things. And I knew Zach from touring with the Oblivions and hanging out in Memphis. And he moved back to Memphis, and we wanted to do something, a store of some sort. And just looking around for opportunities, and Greg Cartwright had been doing Legbo Records out of this space on Young and was moving to North Carolina, and offered us, or told us, that it would, you know, be a good idea to take over the store, whatever, do a record store out of here. And it just kind of made sense. Everything we had, I had built up the mail order pretty big. You know, I had a small selection of, you know, few hundred records or whatever that I was selling the mail order. And so we took over the space, started buying collections and stuff, and then doing the retail mail order new and used stuff, you know, in the store full time, you know, and kicked up the label to a real deal too.
How much of the business would you say is like the store versus the label side?
It's about 50-50, I think, right now. You know, it's both, and varies a little bit from year to year, depending on what we're putting out and how the store is doing. But it's a good mix.
Is there a division of labor, like, within you and Zach and the other folks? I mean, is like one person more in charge of the label or the store, or is it all just kind of 50-50?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of share everything. There's certain things that that Zach takes care of, and certain things that I take care of, and basically we put everything on Hoppy to do everything. Basically, we just sit back and, you know, let him run.
Let the
everything.
Checks roll in.
Yeah, that's right. John Hoppy runs everything in the store. So, but it's a good mix. We don't have any, we have a lot of things are sort of up in the air that somehow get done every time, hopefully. And Goner Fest is sort of the same thing. We do our yearly festival, and
this will be what, the eighth year?
This is the ninth year, 10th festival. 1 year we did two in a year. We got really ambitious, and then we realized that was not a good idea. So, this is our 10th festival, coming into our 10th year next year. So exciting stuff, and it's going to be big. We got Mudhoney coming in for that one. Cosmic Psychos.
It's going to be huge.
Bigger bands. It's going to be really awesome. So
how did that festival start? Whose idea was that?
Yeah, that was another thing. We started the store, and we started putting out records, and two of the bigger records that we had, one of them was King Louie, one man band, Chinese Crawfish, and King Kong and Barbecue Show record were coming out basically at the same time. And they King Kong and Barbecue Show were coming through town, and we thought, well, we'll get Louie up from New Orleans, put him on one each night, and add some local bands, and call it a festival. It was sort of a joke. It was at the Buccaneer. You can get maybe 50 people in there.
Comfortably.
Yeah. And so we called it Goner Fest, and all of a sudden people started flying in from Italy and all kinds of, they basically wanted to come to Memphis, and this was a good excuse.
Yeah.
And people wanted to open up. The Black Lips were on the bill. You know, they were touring with King Kong and Barbecue Show. They're bigger name than, you know, all that stuff even then, but they really weren't the reason that we had the festival, you know.
Yeah.
So it got really crazy. There were like 200 people trying to fit into the Buccaneer, running around the outside of the Buccaneer, trying to get in the back door because they couldn't get in the front door. Completely nuts.
So it was pretty much a success from the start.
It was a success accidentally. You know, we really did not plan to have it work like that. And, you know, it was just one of those things where you kind of put these things together and people really wanted to make it. It wasn't our marketing or anything. It was just that people really wanted this to happen, and it just kind of worked out perfectly.
How much would you say of the people who attend Goner Fest, how many of those people are from town and how many, you know, come in from out of town?
It's probably like 60-40 from out of town, 75%, something like that. It's a lot of people from out of town. A lot of people from Australia come in. It's a long ways to come, but they love coming to Memphis.
Yeah.
I do not know why.
You know, we see a lot of them at Shangri-La as well. Yeah. I mean, Goner Fest week is one of the biggest weeks we have at the store. So thank you.
Yeah, no,
thank you for throwing
great.
A festival.
I mean, we bring people into town for the barbecue. You know, we warn our barbecue shops that they're going to get, you know, 30
they're
people in
slammed.
The middle of September for no apparent reason. You know, they might know that Memphis in May people are coming in, but yeah, they get slammed. So it's great. You know, it's like all our favorite stuff. Hopefully we try to push them towards other record stores, barbecue shops, bars, nightclubs. You know, it's kind of taking care of the people that take care of you and you know, making sure that they have a good time in Memphis and they want to come back and spread the word. And it's just kind of, you know, all that stuff adds up eventually. We're small in the big scheme of things, but I think it helps.
Well, there's almost like a South by Southwestian quality to it in that there's not, you know, the last couple of years there have been unofficial shows and like post shows and pre shows that aren't even really part of the program.
Yeah, the festival, I mean, we sort of did that. We realized that was happening, so we started booking day shows ourselves just because we had so many bands coming wanting to play from out of town. We didn't want it to get screwed up too badly. We could manage to screw it up ourselves. That would be fine, but we didn't want people to just come and have kind of mediocre people. There's so many bands that want to play anyway that we just organized it into a little bit more organized thing, and then the night after parties and stuff, we've kind of let those fly, and those have all been really amazing for people that have the stamina to stay, you know, see a six band show and then go see another four bands till 4 a.m.
I know.
Or
I don't,
six in the morning. Whatever
I had to get up
doing.
And see it at like 11 or noon,
right.
Start all over again.
Yeah. People, that's why they're here. You know, it's, they want that overload. The festival should be pretty much enough for any human, but there's, you know, inhuman people that are just craving more rock. So, yeah, it's fun. And then, you know, they're hanging out with people that are into the same kind of thing, too, from all over the place. So it's really a fun weekend.
It's, you know, I've been to a few of them now, and it just really amazes me, like, how the vibe of the crowd is so overwhelmingly, you know, positive and polite. I mean, people really like pay attention to the music. It's not like your average Memphis show where people are hanging out in the back and they're talking, they're smoking in the back room. You know, people actually are engaged in the music. And
yeah, that's why, I mean, that's why they're here. A lot of people came a long ways to be there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's fun to get drunk and talk to your buddies, but I mean, that's pretty much, you could do that anywhere. That's, they came to see this band from Cleveland that no one has heard of, you know, no one locally has heard of. And it's, yeah, the vibe is really good without being, you know, it could be lame in a way if everybody was just appreciating it. They're out there getting hammered and having fun. But yeah, that's why they're there. It's really cool.
There's such a economic impact on the city when it happens. Have you had much interactions with, like, you know, civic leaders or any kind of, you know, about, you know, the effect of Goner Fest on the town, or does like the Memphis establishment just like kind of not even know it exists, do you think?
No, I mean, we talk to the Convention and Visitors Bureau. They usually help us out, which is great. They see that, you know, we're bringing people to town. I think the mayor gave us a shout-out or some kind of thing last year. He's been pretty good about doing that kind of thing. You know, I think they get it, you know, that all this kind of thing is a positive thing for the city. And anytime that people are talking about Memphis out of town or nationally, it's great, you know. So they're not completely out of the loop. Even though we are small, we're not like bringing a Kojic convention and filling every hotel room, but
yeah,
we do fill up, you know, some motels, you know.
Sure.
And they're eating a barbecue and supporting small local businesses and things, and you know, so they get it. It's we're small. We had FedEx as a sponsor last year, you know. It's some of the
That's
bigger
crazy.
People, yeah, you know, it's great, and it's probably not a big deal to them, but it's a big deal to us, and it's a big deal to help the bands without sounding like you're going corporate or whatever. We use that stuff to bring the same bands that, you know, if we got $50 from, you know, someone that makes silkscreen tickets or stickers or t-shirts or something, you know, it's the same festival. It doesn't change because those people are involved.
That's just so crazy because, you know, I kind of grew up around punk rock myself, and you know, I remember the stigma, and it's just hard to imagine a world in which FedEx and the mayor would actually endorse a punk rock festival.
Right, it is totally unpunk rock, and that sucks. We suck.
But, that's not how I meant that.
No, I know it sounds stupid to me too, but you know, it somehow it all comes together in a way that I think makes sense and helps the festival do what we do even better. You know, if all the money goes to, you know, the bands that want to come here, they basically are paying their own way. We don't have enough money to pay everybody as well as we should. There's 35 bands that come here, and they basically are coming to see the other bands too. They're fans of the kind of music that we're playing, and so yeah.
And I mean, there's a lot of amazing, you know, music journalists and folks like that floating around. I mean, it is an exposure thing too, which again is kind of a South by Southwesty element of it.
It helps everybody, I think, and you know, everybody just has a good time. If people will travel to have a good time, even journalists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Yeah.
So let's get back into the Oblivions now, because you guys are back together. How did the Oblivions reunion take place?
We kept doing reunions. We did, you know, there's scattered shows here.
The first
and there.
One was?
That was the Halloween. I don't even know what year that was. But Halloween.
Did you
show,
ever think of yourself as broken up? Or
oh,
you
yeah,
just think
we were
it?
Broken up.
Okay.
And then, you know, people kept bugging us, and it seemed to make sense to do the show in Memphis. Brought the Cheater Slicks down from Ohio. And that was an amazing weekend. That was basically the start of, I guess it was right before we started doing Goner Fest. So it was the same idea. Like there was a show at Murphy's the night before, the day of kind of thing. People traveled into town, all kinds of bands were in town, and it was just great. Everybody had a great time. And we had fun. We had a lot of fun doing it. But we didn't really look at it as like the band was back together. We've sort of kept it like that. We've done shows here and there as opportunities, or we wanted to do it.
And then there was the tour with the Gories as well, I remember.
And then, yeah, we had a chance to do this European tour with the Gories, who is basically my favorite band as I was growing up, but my favorite band back in the day. And we got to know those guys, and it just seemed to make sense.
You guys were fairly similar musically.
Yeah, I mean, they're a basic kind of garage band based in 60s stuff or whatever. I don't think we sound anything alike other than, you know, it's basically the same concept, two guitars and drums, and big fans of theirs. So to get to watch them every night was amazing. So we did 3 weeks, something like that, in Europe, which was plenty. And we came back and then started talking a little bit about doing some recording, and eventually Greg had done some recording with in Nashville at Dan Auerbach's studio, which was a reel-to-reel deal.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And
that's the the Scion record or whatever, right?
No, we did. Scion record. Yeah, that's right. We did some recording for. We did a Scion single in New York with. God, who did we record with? Spacing out. Anyway, the recording went well. We did some. It was kind of afternoon run in there and do some tricks. I was with.
You're gonna get it.
God,
I'm Steve feeling
Ball
it,
baby, dude. It was great, Matt Verderay and Ivan Julian. I guess he and Ivan Julian from Richard Hell and the Voidoids have a studio. And that was cool, fun little one-off thing. And then we did this Nashville thing where we had booked time and days to record, and we took Doug Easley up there to produce, which is kind of hilarious if anybody knows Doug Easley, because he is like Zen master of recording. It's kind of like if you get a good sound and you do it right, it's going to sound good. And Doug could tell you if it sounded good or not, but he's not going to produce it for you. You have to do it yourself. We went up there and the studio was cool. Really nice instruments. Dan came by and said hi and went off to, I think, play the Super Bowl or something. You know, some ridiculous thing while we were up there, which I didn't realize until later or whatever. I could have the timing wrong, but something like that. And
you know, he came, just a quick aside, he came in the store while he was in town for the music fest.
Yeah.
And just got mobbed. It was
really,
it was insane. Like, we sold every Black Keys record we had, and people were, can we borrow your,
I mean, they love them. It's great, you know. And
was he an Oblivions fan? Was he aware of you guys?
I don't know. You know, it's a totally different thing. Two guitars and drums as opposed to one guitar and drums. So probably never heard of, you know, who knows? I guess he's more of White Stripes thing. I don't know. He was. I met him one time. You know, that was the thing. And Doug was sitting there watching. The engineer that we had at his studio had wired the whole place. Was really hands on, and his reel to reel thing kept breaking. Those old modules were going out to listen back to what you did. You had to change out whole big modules, which was like a big deal.
Yeah.
So it took a long time because the equipment wasn't working right. And Doug was sitting there looking at it going, man, I've got a broken reel to reel that, you know, we could have done all this stuff in Memphis if you wanted to. So we did. We came back to Memphis and Doug was like, man, you want to do some recording? We tried a couple songs down in Doug's studio afterwards. And I think something ended up on there. We did some overdub. I don't remember exactly. And that was fine. You know, it was fun being in the studio with Doug again. And so it was a good mix of that kind of stuff. And we spent time. Played songs over and over again, trying to get them right, which is kind of funny if you know the Oblivions kind of style, you know.
How it was different from like the way you guys made records, you know, like in the 90s.
Well, yeah, we were actually trying to get things right a little bit more, failing, which is pretty Oblivion style, you know, and ending up, you know, being happy with what we got, just sort of like the old style. I think we kind of had a more slapdash, or we just played together more. You know, we haven't really played that much together, so it takes a second to get back into the groove, you know, and figuring out. Jack doesn't play drums, you know, Greg doesn't play drums, so getting those guys comfortable playing drums on the songs and working out how the rhythms are going to work and thinking
I've seen Jack play drums in lots of bands.
Yeah, he does, but he doesn't play drums, you know, regularly like we were for the Oblivions. You know, everybody would play drums for their little bit or whatever. I think it was just, and then just, you know, being on the same wavelength takes a second. So it was a little bit different, and it was a little bit more work than the Oblivions were used to. But I think it turned out pretty good. Everybody brought songs, and we made them Oblivionized as opposed to you know, just a raining sound song played by the Oblivions, I think. I hope, you know.
Yeah.
That was sort of the danger, I think, that everybody was kind of like making it a solo record by anybody and not having the kind of vibe. But at least for us, it was totally, again, it's you throw this stuff at different players, you know, and I think all of us together have a thing that just sounds kind of cool. So
what do you think is the difference between, like, you know, an Oblivion song and, you know, say a Tear Jerkers or Raining Sound or even, you know, T-Sod or whatever? I mean, what is that special thing that,
you know, I think I was, you know, I can't take credit. It's kind of more blame on me than anything, but, you know, I really have a very basic knowledge of the guitar and songs and everything.
Are you the punk rock one?
I'm only because I'm incompetent. You know, those guys could write a better punk rock song than I could if they tried, just because they have more tools at their disposal. That's the thing when you try to badmouth someone that can actually play guitar or, you know, or knows how to paint. They can do so many more things than you can. You know, you can do one thing, and, you know, trying to say that they suck because they can, you know, they know how to do hammer-ons or something. It's like, well, you can't. You know, if you wanted to do that, you can't do it. So, you know, if there's a place where that would make your song better, you're limited.
I think you undersell yourself a little bit here.
Well,
but
it's true. I mean, so I think that we kind of, that is the kind of dynamic, you know, those guys have people around them that allow them to go a lot of different directions, and we kind of together, we are limited in a way that for whatever reason turns out pretty cool.
Well, seems like the store's about to open, isn't it?
Yeah, we should probably
wrap it
get
up,
get out of the way, and
Before we do that,
sell,
I think,
some CDs.
Yeah, definitely. You want to sell some CDs and some Kissingles, maybe.
Yeah.
Do you have any Kissingles in the store?
We probably do. Yeah, if you're looking for Kissingles, come see us.
Well, I have to ask about probably what everyone is going to be listening to this podcast to hear about is True Sons of Thunder.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Maybe my favorite local band, honestly. Still.
Thank you. We came together. I always wanted to play with Richard Martin, who had been in Corn for Texture back in the day.
which is one of my favorite local band names of all time.
Yeah, which was him and Roger Moneymaker, and I think this guy Chris Finney, I think, was in the band, and they were just basically a freeform kind of noise, Cabaret Voltaire kind of thing. Played on some Tab Falco fests and stuff. It's just amazing. He has a kind of homemade guitar, band guitar, half banjo, half guitar, half noisemaker, custom amp, just makes noise. And he somehow knows how to control this thing, somehow, sort of not.
But if you could call it controlling.
Yeah, not controlling, but he makes it sound good. And so I wanted to play with him, and Sam Lehmer had moved up from New Orleans. He had been in a band, Mangina, that was some of our friends been in. Abe White had been in the Oscars, and he wanted to do stuff and sort of threw everybody. Joe T was in the Rat Traps and was in between bands. He's in the Sharp Balloons now. But we all kind of threw it together. None of us really knew each other that well, so it was kind of fun just seeing what came out of it, and it's turned into this big, fun kind of aggressive, kind of silly mess of droney songs, punk rock songs, who knows what songs. Richard's an amazing songwriter, except that he can never remember what song we just did, or might not even know what song we're doing.
It seems like I remember recording you guys at one point, and like you guys were playing a song and he was singing another song.
Yeah, he's really good at that. The thing is too, he is really good at that. He will make the lyrics from another song fit on whatever song you're playing. So
you kind of have to capture lightning in a bottle with him.
Yes, if you don't capture it, it's gone. So it's just kind of we put out a record. We've got another record coming out on Little Big Chief Records called Stop and Smell Your Face.
where did you guys do most of that?
Actually, it's the same recordings that we've had. Some of your stuff we did.
Is some of my stuff gonna be on there?
I think so. I've lost track of where any of this stuff came from. We recorded with Harry K,
yeah.
JD, some Andrew McCullough, and I think we did another Rocket Science stuff, the epic CUP, which we recorded at Rocket Science using the toilet had a very specific clank, one of those things where you flush the toilet and the whole thing goes ka-ching.
We captured that
and that is a major part of that song, so we're excited. It's like 6 minutes, 8 minutes long, so no one else would put it
as opposed to the pedestrian 4 minute version
that version was great too. I think that version has two different Richard tracks on it talking to himself.
It's kind of a dialogue,
yeah, which is another amazing thing that he talks to himself more than anyone else. So we're excited about that kind of stuff. That's been the band that we played the most around town, and got out of town a little bit, played in Cleveland, played in Columbus. We were supposed to play a horrible fest in Cleveland. Abe broke his foot. Couldn't do that. So
saving a cat
next year.
The cat saved?
The cat was saved the next day. Abe did not save the cat. He fell out of the tree, broke his ankle.
Really?
Next day, they borrowed a ladder from the people working on Overton Square and got the cat down. So much better way to do things if you're looking to save a cat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't break your ankle. So anyway, yeah, look for that record coming out hopefully by the fall, summer, maybe. Stop and smell your face. Good advice anyway.
Well, man, I know you're about to open, so I guess we'll call it a day, but thanks for taking the time to do this.
Sure thing. Edit it heavily.
We probably won't edit it at all, actually.
Edit it heavily.
Yeah. Yeah. Not at all.
Make me say cool things in a cool radio voice.
Believe it or not, that's the shortest podcast I've ever taped.